BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Israelis have about 200 nukes in the Middle East, but that's not enough. They're sending commandos into Iran to do bombings and assassinations. Closer to home, environmental groups unite to brighten up Bristol city centre, and the government declaring the southwest of England a marine park. Is there any substance to these words? Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth is here. And as housing benefit and social security come under the coalition chopping block, Will Stone's here from Avon and Bristol Law Centre to explain some of your rights. Also, postponed from last week, French A Hospital, with a world-beating reputation, is set to close. But the new Southmead Hospital is being built under PFI at the same time. And as North Bristol NHS Trust goes foundation status, is this all too much change at the same time, when there's also talk of NHS privatisation? We get the lowdown from North Bristol NHS Trust's outgoing chief executive, Ruth Brunt. Plus, was Richard Branson right to call for the decriminalisation of drugs? Is there really a massive gulf between heroin and alcohol? And we take an expert opinion on what the really big drug dealers and organised criminals fear the most. Danny Kushlick from Bristol-based national drug charity Transform is here. But first, Martin Summers is along to bring us up to date with events in the Middle East. And Martin, first of all, the story that I mentioned right at the very start, which is about a new commando outfit from the Israelis. They're now talking about a whole unit called the Depth Corps, that's what they're calling it anyway, Depth Corps, to operate deep inside enemy territory, specifically inside Iran. The commander's Major General Shai Avital. So what about this? This seems almost like it's going to destabilise things more.
Well, I mean, not just the Israelis, also MI6 and the CIA have been involved in terrorist atrocities inside Iran for some time, where the Iranians are behaving with commendable restraint. But of course, it's actually the war with Iran has effectively started. People are being killed with our taxes as we speak, and it's going to end in mega tears.
But when the Israelis talk about this kind of thing, isn't there an element of it just being a kind of scare tactic to sort of frighten the Iranians, maybe to overreacting?
Well, I object to people making threats full stop. So when Obama and William Hague, for example, say they rule nothing in and nothing out in relation to Iran, that means A, they're committed, they're prepared to go to war, and B, they won't use that first use of nuclear weapons. Now, as far as I'm concerned, those are totally unacceptable positions to take. They are likely to bring a war on. I don't think there's any public support in Britain for a war with Iran. If you go out and talk to people in the street, virtually 100% people will say we don't want a war with Iran under any circumstances. So why aren't our political leaders listening to that?
Now, you and I, as we've said several times on this programme, have spoken to a specific British soldier who has been inside Iran, working covertly there, some kind of special forces. We're now hearing also about the Israelis doing the same thing quite openly, rather than the British who've been doing it in an underhand fashion. I mean, how does this square with the rule of law in the United Nations?
Well, it doesn't. And, of course, all of these things are creating the potential for a major conflagration.
But, I mean, with weakness at the United Nations, isn't this kind of thing inevitable?
Well, the United Nations basically has been undermined by the big powers, specifically the US. For example, they only want the United Nations when it says things they want to hear. When it says things they don't want to hear, they don't want to know about it.
Also, what about the sanctions? Because it's quite clear that China and India, and probably Russia too, are still going to be buying Iranian oil. So what's the point of those sanctions? Well, also, I mean, you know, I know the Italians and the Greeks really depend on Iranian oil.
Yes, I mean, there's two points to make there. One, while we're trying, they're having desperate attempts to save the euro in one room, in another room, there's a decision being taken to cut off Greece and the southern Europe's oil supply from Iran, whack up the oil price and make any possibility of these countries being able to pay their way impossible. So, you know, left hand and right hand not knowing what they're doing there. And, you know, that's a major point I'd make about it. And also, you know, there's... Well, I was going to make another point, but I've forgotten it, so let's move on.
Well, I was just talking about the Chinese taking the oil from Iran,
yes,
as well.
The big problem for the Americans is that they want to preserve the petrodollar system. That means that you have to buy oil in dollars, because they made an agreement with the Saudis to do that in 1973, and it means that everybody has to basically use the dollar to buy oil. But the Iranians are now being forced to find other methods of getting people to buy their oil. The Indians, I understand, are going to pay in gold, and the Russians are going to pay in rubles and so on. This actually starts to undermine the dollar as a reserve currency, and that is actually what most of the fighting and wars have been about. The invasion of Iraq in 2003 was after Saddam Hussein started talking about using the euro to sell oil in, and the Iranians were talking about using the euro to sell oil in, but because of the EU foreign minister decided to with this oil embargo, they're now moving away from the euro, and they're now talking about gold and other substitutes in order to buy oil, all of which potentially threatens the US economy, because if the dollar's reserve currency status goes, they will get hyperinflation inside.
Well, it's bizarre, isn't it? It sounds like they're shooting themselves in the foot. And actually, the Iranians, there's absolutely no evidence they're developing a nuclear weapon anyway.
Well, that's not what it's about. The nuclear issue is essentially a hyped issue. They want regime change. They want control of those oil reserves. And the danger of war is probably as close as it's ever been between the West and Iran.
Well, I hate to be so cynical, dangerous, Martin, but is it possible that tiny numbers of bankers and similar types are better on some sort of real crisis, massive leap in the oil price?
Oil speculators.
I mean, isn't this one of the things that happens with these derivative markets, is that people can actually speculate on massive rises in oil prices create that itself.
Exactly. The financial system has become so dysfunctional that those who bet for it to fail are going to win. They're going to win either way, and especially if they're insider bettors. So if they know the actual day when the Israeli strike is going to go in on Iran, they can make sure that their brokers have taken the relevant steps 12 hours before. It's pretty... a pretty sad state of affairs, but most people in this country, I'm afraid, who don't want a war with Iran are very complacent about this, because it could happen any moment and it could escalate very quickly.
Also, we've heard this week the names on the US no-fly list have doubled since the Christmas plot, which was also, of course, related to Iran. Apparently the Iranians were planning to assassinate the Saudi Arabian ambassador to the
apparently.
US.
Well, I mean, nobody believes that plot. I mean, it's talked about by British ministers like William Hague and by American politicians as if there's some proof of this plot. It's completely unbelievable as a plot. Completely unbelievable.
Why is that? I mean, the Americans wouldn't announce it if it was unbelievable, surely.
Yes, they would, because they tell fibs. And of course, once they start telling fibs, you have to discount everything they say. Basically, if you check your facts, you'll find that most of the time they're telling deliberate lies, and they're not to be trusted, frankly.
US Defense Secretary Leon Panetta apparently commented that the Israel will attack Iran in the spring, but now he doesn't want to say any more about it.
He also said that that Iran wasn't developing nuclear weapons. So there's a total doublethink going on here. And basically, a decision has been made to attack Iran. The Iranians know that decision has been taken, and they will probably try and preempt it, although they've got to be very careful not to be seen to fire the first shot. Interestingly enough, they've got masses and masses of Russian and Chinese anti-ship missiles, and there's every possibility that they're going to sink an awful lot of US ships and possibly British ships.
But the thing
is,
we've been hearing all this sort of saber-rattling for years, Martin, haven't we? Is it maybe just saber-rattling?
Saber-rattling in itself is wrong. We shouldn't be threatening to attack people. Going around threatening to attack people, they could quite legitimately say, if you're going to go around threatening to attack us, we're going to attack you first. Take that. That's the obvious response of the Iranian general staff. That's how we'd respond if the Iranians were threatening to attack us.
Finally, Syria. This seems to be one of the real hotbeds at the moment, with a potentially anywhere civil war. To what extent do you think that's a genuine civil war, and to what extent is it being orchestrated?
Well, it is a genuine civil war, that's quite obvious. But outside forces are fishing in troubled waters, it's quite clear. The Russians will not support an embargo on Syria. They won't support a UN no-fly zone. They abstained on the UN no-fly zone on Libya because they presumed that it was a humanitarian exercise. Then it became, it turned out that it was all part of a regime change plan, which was already in the pipeline up on the French Air Force website since 2 years ago, Operation Southern Mistral 2011. And the Russians have basically said, right, well, if you double-cross us once, that's more fool us. Double-cross us twice,
because it's beginning to look.
I can't remember what it is, which way around it's supposed to go. But I mean, they're not going to play ball with it. They've basically given up on trying to negotiate with the Western powers. They're just saying, don't do this. They've got the Admiral Kuznetsov, which is a Russian aircraft carrier in Tarsus, which is there ready to block a NATO no-fly zone. So any attempt by NATO to put in a no-fly zone will run up straight against the Syrian Air Force and against the Russian Air Force. And Assad has also made it clear any outside, direct outside interference, they're infiltrating fighters over the border into Syria. The Free Syrian Army, the head of the Free Syrian Army, is actually a Libyan, originally from Benghazi.
Yeah, he spent a lot of his life in Ireland for some reason.
Yes, yes. Well, he's also been working with the Western intelligence services for a long time, as many Al-Qaeda operatives.
But ultimately, Assad is a dictator.
Yes, and so is the King of Bahrain, so is the President of Mexico, so is the Saudi regime. There's lots of... basically, the British position is we're not going to have any negotiations. The Free Syrian Army have been told by the West not to try and negotiate with Assad. And there are elements within the Syrian opposition who want to try and negotiate with Assad. They've been sidelined. So the British government's position is we don't do negotiations. It's bloody revolution all the way. And that's got to be exactly the same in the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia. I look forward to the day when the King of Saudi Arabia, the King of Bahrain, are sodomised with a bayonet and shot through the head on YouTube like Gaddafi and their allies. That means that David Cameron and others are allies with the King of Bahrain and King of Saudi Arabia, and we're all bloody revolutionaries now. The Bonnet Rouge.
You seem to be painting a picture of a total breakdown of the rule of law.
Well, if there's no rules, there's no rules. And don't go crying for your mummy when that comes. That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. There will be no rules.
So do you think
we've
come up against a brick wall now? It's not going to go any further with Syria and Iran now, maybe?
I think the Russians have blocked any further intervention in Syria. It will carry on being an open wound. What Assad wants and what should be happening, and in fact, the Arab League delegation, their report is actually very balanced, but it's not been reported in our media. The journalists that were killed by Free Syrian Army mortars, not by the government, the regime. What you've got is a developing civil war in Syria, and the West is actually stirring the pot and encouraging that civil war. That's absolutely irresponsible from my point of view.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, from Damascus back to Bristol, and I'm joined by Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth. Hi, Mike. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening, Tim.
Now, we have a launch today of something called the Living Heart for Bristol. Living Heart for Bristol. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Those of us who've got sort of long memories, been in the city for a while, and those perhaps people who are new to the city might be really quite astonished to know that 20 years ago, that huge, magnificent open space of Queen Square, which is now used for parties and concerts in the summer, used to have a dual carriageway road slicing right across, diagonally across the middle of it. And that was part of the inner circuit road of Bristol, so it was a major road. 20 years ago, the council took a bold step and they said, this is not an appropriate way to have a great public space in a city centre. They cut that road. They took the road away from the front of the... used to go between the cathedral and the council house on the side of College Green. And in doing so, those two radical steps, which were both somewhat opposed at the time, nevertheless have created us two fine open public spaces which are now widely enjoyed. But the momentum sort of stopped there, and over the last 20 years there haven't been any further steps to reclaim further public areas in the centre of Bristol for people and reduce the dominance of the motor car. And the Living Heart campaign is basically saying it's about time to return to this issue and look at the gains that we made in the past and how can we carry them on in the future. And fundamentally what we're saying is that we're not proposing that people would not be allowed to drive into the centre of Bristol. If people have business there, if they're residents, if they've got a reason why they need to take a car into the centre of Bristol, then there would be absolutely no block on people doing that. But what we are trying to prevent from happening is people using the centre of Bristol as a rat run to get from one side to the other. And we believe that if the through traffic is removed, this will have a significant difference to the atmosphere of the centre, literally the atmosphere as we breathe it. It will be a calmer place. It will be a place that will be more enjoyable for pedestrians and cyclists to use, and the economy of the centre would benefit as a result.
But what about the inner ring road? Because that's going to become horrendously busy, surely. I mean, if you go to London, you look at the kind of congestion zone that they put there, all the way around the edge of that, it's incredibly congested.
Well, lots of other cities have actually done this sort of step of freeing central areas from through traffic, and this tends to be that this isn't what happens, that actually people change their travel habits, and it isn't just a question of sort of diverting onto another road. Quite often people rethink whether they need to make that journey by car at all, and that sort of thing. So it doesn't necessarily just displace traffic onto other roads. The gains are wider than just the central area.
Well, one thing that would help with this a lot is if the public transport was better. Mike, what groups are involved in this then?
Well, we've been part of a coalition here working with groups like Living Streets, the Bristol Green Capital Group, and a group that is called Car Free Bristol, which is not actually about removing all cars from Bristol. It's about promoting car-free developments in Bristol. So it's a coalition of groups, most of whom are sort of representing the interests of greener modes of transport, cycling and walking particularly.
And is there anywhere we can have a look to see, maybe physically? Yeah. Or on the web to see your vision for the city centre?
We've got a website. If you look for Living Heart for Bristol, you'll find it.
In fact, I can tell you exactly what their website is. I've got a crib in front of me here. It says www.livingheart.org.uk.
Okay, so we're putting material on there which explains what the vision is, and we'll be adding some more detailed proposals as time goes on. But at the stage really of just kind of punting this out as an idea, as a concept, trying to reclaim the idea that the centre of Bristol needs to be taken back for people.
Well, apparently in Bordeaux, it was all done in one fell swoop, like one morning. Suddenly loads and loads of roads were blocked off. I mean, surely that's going to really annoy people if they do that here.
Well, I mean, sometimes actually the way to do this is to change things radically overnight. If you try and do it piecemeal, incrementally, bit by bit, then you just get a lot of pain and anguish and battles over every inch of the way. So maybe if we just sort of said, right, this is the plan, this is how it's going to happen.
Now, also, the government's announced a marine park for the southwest of England. What's your reaction to that?
This is an announcement that came out from the government a couple of weeks ago now.
Sounds like they're going to flood us or something.
we've welcomed. Because the government has quite rightly recognised that there is a big potential future in various kinds of marine energy, wave energy, tidal stream, which is like a sort of upside down wind turbine, if you can imagine it. So the blades are in the water, and the backwards and forwards ebb and flow of the tide.
Yeah, well, we have this amazing energy. Tidal reach, don't we, in the city? Isn't it one of the biggest in the world?
The up and down fall of the tide at Avonmouth, is I think the second biggest in the world. But this is actually talking about, this could go somewhere like off the coast of North Devon or in an English Channel where you've got strong currents flowing backwards and forwards. And we're building up quite a sort of centre of expertise and knowledge about these new technologies in the southwest of England. So what the government was saying basically is that they want to bring these things together, declare the southwest a marine energy park in their terms, which at this stage doesn't actually mean very much happening on the ground, but it does mean sort of trying to link up, cluster together the universities, some practical projects that are happening. So you've got something called the Wave Hub off the north coast of Cornwall, and some industries, and look at revitalising some of the southwest ports. You know, we've got moribund ports around our coastline, which aren't really kind of the centres of industry that they used to be. So we think there's potentially a big win here for the future of the southwest.
Well, what about let's just get back to for a minute to my slight obsession with this tidal reach and along the Avon Gorge. Is it feasible to stick a couple of turbines? I mean, because we don't have these sailing ships going backwards and forwards along the cut anymore, do we? So there doesn't seem to be any reason why we can't just sort of stick some turbines turbines and actually be making, generating fantastic amounts of electricity as the tide goes in and out every day. Because I'm not sure what it is, 20 feet or something up and down. It goes 40 twice, feet. Yeah. 40 feet every twice a day. It goes up and down. That's a fantastic amount of water.
Yeah. Well, one of the proposals when the government was sponsoring studies into a Severn barrage a couple of years ago was for what was called a tidal fence, where you'd have an array of these turbines sort of basically somewhere around where the two bridges are at the moment, where the water current is moving very, very fast in and out. But that was, you know, the government has decided not to finance further Severn barrage studies. But this tidal stream technology, which is a little bit further over the horizon, but nevertheless it's something we could, you know, get in at an early stage and develop. It can certainly be applied in the Bristol Channel, but it can be applied in lots of places around the British coast.
But we won't need any of this once good old Hinkley Power Station starts up with its wonderful new tens of thousands of years of radiation and pollution for all our children. So how's that looking, Hinkley Oldbury Power Station?
There was a report issued earlier this week under the title of A Corruption of Governance. It was issued by a group called Unlock Democracy, who used to be called Charter, campaigning for, you know, democratic renewal. And they had gone back and looked at some of the evidence that the government was putting forward to say that we had to have nuclear in order to sort of keep the lights burning, and finding really that it came down to a sort of series of assertions by some civil servants, some industry figures, that just then find their way into government policy. They're never critically examined. So the argument that we need to have nuclear Hinkley or anywhere else is based on a very, very shaky foundation indeed.
Okay. Martin, can I just bring you in on this? Because, I mean, I know there are all sorts of economic aspects to nuclear power. We just heard the Marine Energy Park, possibly, with all sorts of diverse ways of using water power, wave power, wind power around the region. You know, at Hinkley, there's still the possibility of this brand new nuclear power station being built. What about the economics of it all?
Well, the economics of nuclear power don't really stack up. They never have. If you have to take account of getting rid of the waste, the private sector is very rarely prepared to countenance financing nuclear energy. Basically, it has to be underwritten by the government or it doesn't happen. And the real answer to a lot of our problems is energy efficiency. It's not, we need to consume a lot less energy to have exactly the same output, and the technology for that is absolutely established. It's nothing new. We've just got to do it.
Okay, Mike, can you just tell us where we can find you on the internet, Southwest Friends of the Earth, and if you've got any meetings coming up?
Yeah, go for bristolfode.org.uk. The Bristol Friends of the Earth is actually having its AGM on Tuesday next week, and that will be in the Big Chill Bar. Look on the website for the venues in the city centre.
And your phone number?
And my phone number is Bristol 942-0128.
Okay, Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, now I'm joined by Will Stone from the Avon and Bristol Law Centre. Hi, Will. Welcome to Drive Time while you're settling yourself down in the chair there.
Thank you, Tony.
The one of the big things that's been in the news over the last few weeks is the backlash against the Big Issue seller, who's now being treated as self-employed by the benefits judge. Her crime is being Romanian. So can you just give us a bit of an idea of the background to this?
Well, yes. I mean, the response to this particular issue has surprised and quite frankly shocked us at the Law Centre. If you look on our friends, the Daily Mail's website, there was some really quite offensive postings that were put on that website, which we had to actually make complaints about and ask to be removed. We received at the Law Centre ourselves some very nasty emails, and we've been continuing to do that this week. Even the Evening Post last week, the letters page was full of letters criticising that decision.
Well, surely people have a right to criticise the decision, because what they're saying essentially is that someone from who's come over from Romania shouldn't have the same rights to all the various benefits as we have here in Britain.
Yes, of course people have the right to make their voice known, but what concerns us is the misguided information and the misguided views that have really come about this case. The decision that was made by the judge was was on a very narrow point of law, which affects very, very few people. It was just simply saying that the rule that says if you're selling the big issue, you're self-employed, which has been applied for years by the Inland Revenue against the very same people, also applies in social security law. So it's just setting things straight. The number of people that it actually affects is, I would imagine, across the whole country, simply a handful.
So is this the only inaccuracy which has been involved in the reporting? You're mentioning the Daily Mail article there. And of course, if it's inaccurately reported, a story, this gets people's backs up and they may be, you know, actually veering towards a sort of racist and quite abusive approach, as you were saying.
Well, that's what's happened as well, and an awful lot of focus has focused on the amount of benefits that she's getting, which was very much an overestimation. And it's also important to remember that some of the benefits that she's reported to be getting were not her benefits; they were benefits that were for her disabled child. And if those benefits weren't being paid, there would be an additional cost to the local community because services would have to be brought in and paid for by the National Health Service, by the social securities, by the social services, by the local authority. So, in fact, there's a saving there. The other thing I think that's important to remember, looking at the wider picture, is that when somebody receives benefits, those benefits are paid essentially to keep them off the breadline. They don't have an awful lot of spare cash out of those benefits. So most of that money is spent in the local economy, which of course is a good thing. It's used to buy food, to buy clothes, to buy things from local services and businesses, which is good for the local economy. It's interesting that when you hear, although there is a controversy about bankers receiving bonuses of worth millions of pounds in shares, that of course is not money, rightly or wrongly, that is not money that goes into a local economy. That's money that just simply sits in a bank account, in a portfolio, and does absolutely nothing to improve the economy in the situation that we find ourselves in now.
But many people will be thinking, well, I mean, you know, maybe the best thing to do if you want people to actually go back to the country where they came from is just to cut their benefits off, then they'll have to go back.
That may well not happen. If you cut people's benefits, what will happen is that you will need to use other services, such as people will have to call on the social services where children are involved. Social services would have a duty to step in and to ensure that that family wasn't destitute. I don't think there'd be any evidence to suggest that people would then leave. Many people who come here immigrants to work or whatever, what we found is that after a few years they tend to go back. If you look at the Polish communities, a huge influx of Polish workers who came here, they did a fantastic job. Everybody praised what great workers they were. When the work dried up, they went back to Poland.
Now, there's also the issue of the benefit cap, which over the last 2 weeks has been being debated by the Lords. What are your thoughts about that? Because, I mean, many people may possibly be forced below the breadline. That is to say, you know, even many of these benefits are actually paid to people in work, in low-paid work, as well as those out of work.
That's right, and I believe a National Children's Charity has voiced quite serious concerns this week about the effect that that will have on children. The benefits cap does not just apply to people who are out of work, it applies to people who are in work and are having to claim benefits to increase their income because they're on a very low wage or they're working very few hours. Again, what you'll find is that services are going to have to be called on, particularly where children are involved, in order to protect those children. Social services, we'll be looking at social services, we'll be looking at the health authorities stepping in. One clearly obvious effect may be that in a few years' time we're looking at a return to the conditions that you had in Victorian Britain. I wouldn't quite say that this government's going to force people back into the workhouse, but you can see that the mentality taken to its extreme end would lead to that.
Martin Summers is also joining us, Old Labour Oxford economist. This whole idea of the benefit cap, Martin, I mean, many of these benefits are being paid in housing benefit, which simply go to private landlords, aren't they?
Yes, indeed they do. I mean, that's one of the biggest expenditures is rent, which is siphoned off by those who have more than one house to rent out.
So it's not actually going into the pockets of people who are claiming the benefit at all.
They don't see any of it.
Anyway, this subject was brought up in the House of Commons at Prime Minister's Questions this week, where Sheila Gillamore MP talked about a 65-year-old constituents of hers who was having to pay £100 out of her actual pension because she'd had £100 taken. Basically, I have a choice of either being evicted from her home or else pay £100 a week of her pension to her landlord. So let's have a listen to that.
Sheila Gillamore!
Some pathetic clothes!
Can the Prime Minister explain why my 65-year-old constituent, who couldn't get a council home, has to pay £100 of her £570 a month rent because of his housing benefit reforms. Why is this Prime Minister so much tougher on the vulnerable than he is on the powerful with their excessive bonuses?
We know they're not going to back us on the welfare cap, and now we can see they're against the housing benefit reforms as well. Let me just remind her what her own welfare minister said. He said it's completely unacceptable that housing benefit has rocketed to £20 billion. And this is what he said. This is what he said. Where is Baldemort? He's not at home today. He said this. Beveridge would scarcely have believed housing benefit alone is costing the UK over £20 billion a year. Now, this government is reforming it. That opposition's doing nothing.
Martin, isn't it absolutely £20 billion a year, David Cameron's saying there, that housing benefit's now costing? I mean, something has to be done, surely.
Yes, we've got to build a whole new generation of council houses and put the homeless into them and charge them decent, reasonable rents, which will actually allow them to get out of benefit traps and take relatively low-paid work. We haven't built any decent social housing in this country for a generation. That's why we're spending money on housing benefit. And most of that £20 billion is going into the pockets of Tory voting to double homeowners. Totally ridiculous.
It's also worth mentioning that until 1988 we had a very effective rent regulation scheme which regulated rents in the private sector and made sure that they were kept at a reasonable and affordable rate. And I can't see that any government would even consider looking at bringing something like that into effect. That's how you solve the housing benefit debt, not by cutting benefits to the people who are having to pay those rents, which is going to end up with them being evicted.
Is there anything that people can do, Will, from a legal point of view, if they're finding that they're simply not getting enough in benefits to make ends meet, and that they're finding that they can't pay electricity bills, they can't pay gas bills, we're in the middle of a really cold spat at the moment, and are they simply going to have to move out or just simply not pay the rent, maybe pay it on their credit card?
Well, obviously I would recommend they come and get advice either from their local advice centre. They could also come and get advice from the law centre. We have caseworkers and solicitors who specifically specialise in welfare benefits and also in debt issues and have a very good track record helping people.
In your experience, are there sometimes benefits out there that people don't know exist?
I think the benefits, I'm not a benefits expert, and I know that the benefit system is extraordinarily complicated. It's complicated because the massive regulation that actually governs it would probably fill this entire room. It's extraordinarily complicated. And, of course, there are going to be benefits that people are unaware that they can claim. They may just need a little bit of encouragement to claim them as well, because of course there is always a stigma attached to claiming benefits, and getting good quality advice can help people do that.
Finally then, we had also in the last couple of weeks this extraordinary case of a woman who was volunteering in a museum. I believe she was a geology graduate, and that she was told that this was the wrong kind of volunteering for her, and that she had to go and work in a Poundland shop and really essentially take the job for free of someone who would be sort of stacking shelves. Is there anything that people can do if they're in that sort of situation where they're trying to actually get work experience which is relevant to their career path or to their qualifications, and they're then told, sorry, you can't do that, you're going to have to go and take on one of these jobs which is actually replacing someone that would otherwise be being paid?
I mean, that really was quite a ridiculous story, wasn't it? Because there she was doing some voluntary work which was benefiting the local community, which was giving her skills which could lead her into a successful career, and then she was asked to go and do a very menial job stacking shelves in a local Poundland, I think it was. Of course, the only people that benefited from that was Poundland, because they got some cheap labour, and I think at the end of the 2 weeks they just sent her back on the dole. Now, in terms of the law, those kind of questions are challengeable. Those kind of decisions would be challengeable because they've got to be seen to be reasonable. The difficulty is that for the claimant and for this particular graduate at that time, in order to do that, she would be taking the risk of having her benefit being cut completely. That may not be a risk that she would actually want to take at that time, and she may think, well, okay, it's only for 2 weeks, I'll go and endure the hard labour for the 2 weeks, and then maybe I can go back to doing my useful volunteering at the end of that. A difficult decision for somebody to make, I think.
Now, Will, finally then, can you just tell us whereabouts you are, the Avon and Bristol Law Centre, and how people can get in touch?
Yeah, the Law Centre is based in Stokes Croft at 2 Moon Street, right opposite the Full Moon Pub. We're open Monday to Friday, 5 days a week. You can ring us on 0117 924 8662. All the details are on our website, which is www.ablc.org.uk.
Will, thanks very much.
Thank you, Tony. BCFM 93.2.
Bristol is our community. Now, postponed from last week, French A Hospital, with a world-beating reputation, set to close, but the new Southmead Hospital is being built under PFI at the same time. And as North Bristol NHS Trust goes to foundation status, is this all too much change at a time when there's talk of privatisation too? We get the lowdown now from North Bristol NHS Trust's outgoing Chief Executive, Ruth Brunt.
I'm Ruth Brunt, and I'm the Chief Executive of North Bristol Trust. Our budget every year is about 500 million, so we're looking at half a billion budget, and we employ 9,500 staff. So we are pretty big, and we have about 1,100 beds across our two hospital sites. So pretty big in health service terms.
And there's lots of changes that we can see if we drive past or walk past or go past on the bus at Southmead with seven big cranes. What's going on there?
Well, we're building a new hospital there, as most people in Bristol will now realise, I'm sure. And hopefully people will have seen a lot of information and some of our publicity about that. Both of our hospital estates are now very old and not fit for purpose and haven't been for some time. And many people will know that the hospital at French A was built by the American Air Force in the Second World War and was only ever intended to last the war. And here we still are carrying out internationally recognised neurosurgery in wartime buildings. So we definitely need something new, and we're very keen to provide a modern healthcare environment for looking after our patients in the future. This will be one of the new generation of new hospitals across the country. There will never have been a hospital like this in the country before, and we think it's really good for Bristol. So what we're doing is we're bringing both hospitals together into one new super hospital. It will have 800 beds. 75% of those will be in single rooms with ensuite bathroom facilities for patients. So hopefully from a patient experience point of view, it will be quite different from the way patients experience care now, and it will be in a light and modern healthcare environment all in one place. Anyone who has visited French A and Southmead will know that you have to travel a long distance often to get to where you need to, whether it's an outpatient clinic or one of the wards. Long, long corridors, difficult to find your way around. This will all be in one building, and it will be very easy for people to be able to access the services that they need in a modern environment. So we're very excited about it. And anyone that's seen the cranes on the Southmead site will know that the building is coming up out of the ground very quickly. We've almost finished the shell of the building, but of course it's going to take a while before we're able to open it, because all the work needs to happen inside. As you can imagine, it takes a while to build an intensive care unit or to build theatres and those sorts of things. So we're on target to open the hospital in April 2014, and at the moment the project is on budget and on target for that date. So more news about that as we get nearer to that time.
But even though it's in an old World War II kind of state, Frenchay's got a fantastic reputation. How are you going to make sure that that does transfer to the new site?
That is really important for us. And so we need to make sure that the reputation we have, which for some of our services, like the burn service, for example, and our brain surgery service, people will know, we offer at a regional and sometimes a national level some of those services. It's going to be really important to us that we take that reputation with us. And so we're talking to our clinical teams at the moment about how do we preserve that Frenchay tradition as we take it forward into the Southmead Hospital. And that will be about, you know, some of the names we use for our wards or for the hospital itself or whatever, but we do need to preserve that Frenchay brand quite definitely.
Yes. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and experience in the past? Where have you come from?
Yeah, well, I'm a nurse and I'm a midwife by background, and I'm also a district nurse by background. I am from a clinical background myself. I've been in the NHS since I was 17, this year will be my 40th year in the NHS. So I've never worked anywhere else, and I absolutely love it. And I am due to be retiring in April after 40 years. So I came to Bristol in 2004, and before then I was working in Devon. So I came from Exeter and North Devon, where I had been director of nursing and acting chief executive there for a while. I've never regretted coming to Bristol. It's a very friendly place to work, North Bristol Trust. And my 7 years here have been very happy and very productive. So I've enjoyed it.
It's a bit of a nerve-wracking time for a lot of people around the health service at the moment. There's talk of privatisation. There's a lot of changes going on. Are you glad to be getting out at the moment? A lot of private businesses moving into the health service.
Well, you could certainly see it like that, certainly. So they've introduced something called the Any Willing Provider, which actually means that anybody who can meet the very stringent standards, both in terms of quality, safety, and from a financial point of view, to deliver healthcare, can actually enter the NHS market. It will still be NHS care, so it will be purchased through the NHS, but potentially could be delivered by a range of different providers, some of which may be private providers. So that certainly is one element of the new NHS reform. But certainly the government have made it quite clear that they are still committed to the principles of the NHS, and that is that patients will receive care free at the point of care, irrespective of their need. And I think that's something that we have to ensure is still very much embodied in the values of the NHS.
The thing is that these private healthcare companies, many of which are based in the United States, are looking at the British health system. They want that business. Their agenda is really for private healthcare.
Well, I suppose so, but there's no indication that in the current NHS reforms that we're going to be looking at private healthcare in the way that it is recognised in the States, in terms of insurance-based healthcare or whatever. There's no indication in the current health and social care policy that that is the intention, although I can understand people's concerns about that.
You're also moving in the North Bristol Trust over to foundation status, which is in the city centre hospitals, happened a few years ago.
Yeah.
You're being told you have to do this. So is it something you actually really want to do, to become a foundation trust? And what does it mean?
Well, we started our application to become a foundation trust a number of years ago now, but then we stopped it because of all the work with New Hospital, and we felt that that was important to get underway first. So we made a positive decision to actually start building our new hospital before we became a foundation trust. But you're right, the government has said that they want every trust in the country to be a foundation trust by 2014, and so we are on a timeline. We feel that now is a very good time for us to become a foundation trust. What it will actually mean is greater freedom from central government and more accountability to our local population. And we think that's actually very important. So one of the key features of becoming a foundation trust is that we recruit a membership from our local population, where people can opt to become a member of our trust, which means that they have an interest in healthcare provision locally at North Bristol Trust.
But don't people just simply want you to be running it in their interest? They don't necessarily want to become members of the NHS, do they?
Well, we've already recruited quite a lot of members for our foundation trust, of people who want to work with us to look at how services can be shaped for the future. And we do have a lot of interested patients and also members of the public who actually feel that they have a stake in how healthcare services will be provided in the future and who want to work with us. Our aim is to recruit 15,000 members within a year of becoming a foundation trust, and we're already well on the way to doing that. Being accountable to your membership, I think, in terms of the types of services that you're providing, is a very important feature of being a foundation trust. And so the strings being pulled from the centre are far less, but we need to be accountable for what we provide to our local population, and I actually think that's very important.
Going back to Southmead Hospital, how are you affording to pay for it? Is it one of these private finance initiatives?
It is a private finance initiative. That's the only way currently at the moment new hospitals are being built in the NHS. In effect, what that actually means is that you take out a mortgage, like any one of us buying a new house would do, but obviously for a very big hospital, that's a pretty large mortgage. And so we take out a mortgage for 30 years, and over a 30-year period, we actually pay back the cost of the new hospital. But we actually enter into an arrangement with a PFI partner who will put the money up front to build the hospital. We have a long-term financial plan, which means we generate sufficient savings every year to be able to pay back the cost of the hospital. At the end of 30 years, that hospital gets handed back to us, and then it becomes ours. It becomes the property of the NHS. And the important thing is that the private finance provider is required to maintain the hospital to the standard that it was when it was built, and so by the time we get the hospital back, it will be in as good a condition in 30 years' time as it was when it was built. And I think that's a very important feature of this. But yes, it does mean that we have to generate savings every year to be able to pay that mortgage back.
So who is your PFI provider then?
It's Carillion is building the hospital for us, and they're one of the big construction industries, and they're responsible for building and maintaining the building.
As someone that's worked a long time in the NHS, and as someone who's leaving soon,
yes.
Can you give us an idea of some of the things that you'd like to see personally change? I mean, you must have had frustrations over the years and seeing that things aren't working the way that you would most prefer.
What's very positive about the current NHS reform is the proposal to really put patients back in the centre of making decisions about their own care. And I think we've lost that a little bit in the NHS over the last few years.
But for patients, surely they want doctors to be making those decisions, not themselves. If they trust the doctor, the doctor's the expert.
But I think there are elements of certainly in my generation, when I need healthcare, I like to think that I can make a choice, that I'm given options about my care, and that people will give me the information I need to be able to make the right choices about A, which hospital I go to, B, what type of treatment I have. I'd like to be able to choose my GP, which is part of the new NHS reform, rather than just being told this is the GP I have to have. So I think... I think what is very positive is that we need to be much more patient-focused in the way we deliver care.
Do you find that patients are more and more looking up things on the internet about their health problems and are coming to you and saying, I think this is what I need, and this is a change that's been brought about by the internet? There is a fantastic amount of information out there about health now.
Yeah, there is. And people do. They turn up in their outpatient clinic having already done their research. And so by the time they actually get to see their doctor, they're saying, look, I've looked this up and it looks like I've got a number of different options here. What do you think about it? So it doesn't always make your life easier as a clinician, but I think it's a very good thing that people want to take more responsibility and for their health. And I think the quality of patient care and the safety of patient care is something that is becoming more important to people. So, you know, the public hear a lot about things like hospital acquired infections. They get very worried about those things. We have to be able to give people the right information about what's happening in our hospital. We have to be very open and honest about when we don't get things right, as well as when we do get things right, so people can make an informed choice about what's best for them in their care. And I think that's a very important feature of the way we're moving now in the health service.
Okay, that's one change you'd like to see. Anything else? If you were the health secretary, you would say, this is the thing we've got to do. We must change this.
What I would like to see is a much more integrated approach across health and social care. I think we've still got a big division between what the health service provides and what social care provides. Sometimes it's very difficult to get patients out of hospital because they're waiting for very complex social care packages, for example. I think if I was the health secretary, I would do something to bring health and social care together and have it run under one umbrella, because I think that would be the one significant change that would make a lot of difference to the way we're able to care for patients across both hospital and community settings.
Well, that was Ruth Brunt speaking to me last month, and she is the outgoing chief executive of the North Bristol NHS Trust, with a massive load of hospitals and tens of thousands of employees. Martin, one of the things that does bother me, though, is this whole private finance initiative that Southmead Hospital is being built under the auspices of, this PFI, as it's called, and Carillion being the people building it. What do you think the likelihood is that in 20, 30 years' time, when this is all finished, that the hospital really will be in a brand new, good as new state to be handed over to the NHS?
Well, I think the PFI was basically a trick by Conservative and Labour governments to say that they're not actually spending taxpayers' money on this. The private sector are coming up with the funds. But of course the private sector charges an awful lot more for doing anything. Basically the government, as big as it is, can actually borrow money much more cheaply than foundation trusts can borrow money from the private sector and getting private sector contractors in. So it's a way basically of trying to kid people that government money isn't being spent, and it allows a rake off for financial services sector, which is, to my mind, irrational.
The other thing is, I was sort of quite cheekily asked Ruth there what she would do if she was Andrew Lansley or Health Secretary, and she said the one thing that she'd really love to change is the complete separation that there is between social care and health at the NHS, because they're finding quite often that because the conditions at home are not good enough, people are staying in hospital, particularly elderly people, much longer than they have to.
Well, that's the argument for having a comprehensive health policy anyway. I mean, the whole idea of, I mean, essentially what is an illness system which treats individual conditions, we ought to be having an overall plan for a healthier society which takes into account all of the factors involved and is a joined up exercise. But of course the whole idea of splitting it into tiny bits and then farming those bits out to any willing provider runs completely counter to that joined up approach.
Well, and also of course the whole business of social care is being increasingly means tested, whereas the National Health Service is free at the point of delivery. It's not as if they're going to you and saying, well, can you afford to pay for this, when if you can afford to pay, you're going to have to take out a mortgage on your house or an annuity on your house and pay from your house. Now this is one of the things that's particularly a lot of elderly people and their families are particularly fretting about. They thought they were going to be able to hand on their homes to the younger generation. Now they're finding, in order to get them looked after in old age, that they have to sell the house.
Yes, and I think that this is actually going to undermine the saving habits of a substantial section of middle-class people. What is the point? I'm thinking of my uncle at this point, who saved quite a considerable sum. He's now basically needs a lot of care and attention, and the money he'd saved up is now being spent on his own care. I mean, he's been a very good kind of citizen in one way. He's paid for his own care, but I don't suppose his son is going to save money in the way he did, because what's the point? And I think ultimately, by providing care for everybody at every level, you actually encourage people to save. The current system actually discourages people to save, and I think the Conservatives are going to regret walking down that road.
But it's actually New Labour that set us on this road, isn't it?
Indeed, the whole road that we've been set on is New Labour stroke Conservative. It's pretty much the same thing. We're talking about two brands of the same thing. I mean, ultimately, Beveridge, who was mentioned earlier in the programme, he would not have been happy with housing benefit at 20 billion, but then he wouldn't have been harassing people to try and find a job when you've got macroeconomically caused mass unemployment. That's absurd. I mean, the Beveridge proposals were based on a full employment society, and when you've got a full employment society where there are jobs for all those who want them, you can legitimately start chivying people. If you've got a situation where you've got a million people under the age of 24 out of work, then harassing people to get a job is basically fatuous.
Also, when we're hearing that a lot of people are actually being told, particularly disabled people, single mums, are being told that they are now going to have to become job seekers. But the thing is that the actual number of jobs out there is going down, at least if you believe those unemployment figures. Last week we heard the last 3 months, 120,000 more unemployed.
Yes, and this is to do with the macroeconomic stance of the government. I mean, we didn't mention this earlier when Alistair was on. I didn't get to it. But, I mean, he's saying that banks aren't lending to small businesses, and that's because you'd be a fool to try and set up a small business as you were about to go into an economic tsunami caused partly by the collapse of the banks and partly by the government's own austerity policy. The banks are quite right. It would be foolish to lend to small businesses.
So who
they
is
just
it?
Lose the money.
So who is it that's making all the money out of this thing?
Well, the finance, insurance and real estate sector is like having cancer. We're talking about health. It's like having cancer in your body, and basically they are eating up all of the resources of the rest of the society. And as the banks go down, the bankers will walk away with their loot, and the rest of us will be left with nothing. And that, and on a global scale, that is going to cause a revolutionary situation and a world war.
Well, Martin, that's a bit of a gloomy way to end, but we're going to have a bit more perky music in a minute. That's all the serious talk out of the way, because after Rupert Murdoch's Sky News at 7, which we won't be hearing tonight, Friday night is Music Night. 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party crew, followed by the UFO show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Conservative spokesman for sports and leisure. Actually, he wasn't for sports and leisure, was he?
No.
Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Alistair Watson, and also to Will Stone from the Avon and Bristol Law Centre, and Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth, and also to the chap you were just hearing there, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, despite being a wealthy Conservative heartland, North Somerset Council seems to be falling to bits, failing to maintain roads, switching off streetlights at night, leading to the death of a soldier over Christmas in Clevedon, and also their Defence Secretary MP from North Somerset was sacked for taking a creepy man who had no security clearance called Werity everywhere around with him. We turn the council inside out to find out what makes them tick. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this programme's 5-point economic recovery plan, analysis of last year's Tesco riots, and a report on mobile phones and wireless safety, as well as a look at the 7/7 and 9/11 attacks. Just go to bcfm.org.uk and find Friday drive time on the right hand side, or else you can go straight to our page by tapping in thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. We have about 65 million people in Britain and 65 million acres of land, so while it might seem there's not enough resources to go around, that's only because banks and big business have hijacked far more than their fair share. All we have to do is make sure the 60 million acres is shared out fairly and with modern technology, not controlled by an elite. We can live happily together. Do please join us at Friday drive time, 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down. I'm going to leave you with some music from before 9/11. Just bring in that pre-9/11 vibe from 1997. It's Gala and Freed from Desire from DIY Music in Italy.
My lover's got no money, he's got his strong beliefs. My lover's got no power, he's got his strong beliefs. My lover's got no fame, he's got his strong beliefs. My lover's got no money, he's got his strong beliefs. Want more and more, people just want more and more. Freedom and love, what he's looking for. Want more and more, people just want more and more. Freedom and love, what he's